between Jews and National Social, Dutch National Socialists, Dutch Nazis. And the Germans punished them. They took 400 Jewish men and arrested them and sent them to Mauthausen concentration camp. In Delft, there was no such thing. Our very good Jewish friend who had a bookstore in Delft, bookstore for the students, mostly textbooks. And he became, in Amsterdam, an organization was formed. It's called the Jewish Council, which began to stand between the Germans and the Jews of Holland.
Like the Judenrat in some of the other countries.
Like a Judenrat in German word. In Holland was called the Joodse Raad, the Jewish Raad, Jewish Council. And we had in Delft one man who was the sort of deputy of that. He was a Mr. Cohn. He was a German Jew, by the way. And he promised us that he would, if there ever was a raid in like they had in Amsterdam, where they began, you know, to pick up Jews on the street, he said he would warn us before they came to get us. He was a good man. As things progressed, we had to wear a star. My mother had to sew a Jewish star on our clothes, of course. And every time I went out in the street, everyone could see that I was a Jewish kid.
When was that decree passed?
I think it was beginning of 1942, maybe. Or maybe the end of 1941. I don't have those days exactly in my mind, but it didn't bother me, by the way. Mm-hmm. Anytime I went out in the street, sometimes Christian people would come up and shake my hand and say, "You'll be proud of that star, Ed. You don't, you know, soon mm-hmm. those Germans will lose the war, they'll go home, and you can take that thing off, and you know, and you'll be proud being Jewish." And, mm-hmm. There were lots of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. For the Dutch, it was kind of an insult in itself, I guess, to see their fellow citizens walking around with a mark on their chest, you know. But the next thing was really the thing that ended our life, so to speak, you could say, as citizens in Holland for that time. A command by decree by the Reichskommissar for the occupied Dutch territories, who announced that all Jews would have to register for work relief in Germany. If you didn't register, you would be sent to Mauthausen concentration camp. And although in those days we didn't know what the Germans really, how evil it was. But one thing was known by that time, because Mauthausen concentration camp was in Germany, it was not in Poland. If you were sent there, you were dead within 3 months. They worked you to death. And so that was the choice of my parents, finally. They had to register for, then the Jewish Council very nicely said that for those people who had registered, should get backpacks. Because it was sometimes, you know, it's cold in those work camps where we were going to work, and my parents got backpacks, and my mother washed and ironed and cut up blankets into small blankets and stuff, the woolen, nice warm underwear, nice warm socks. My father very carefully painted our names on them: Nathan, Angeline, Eddie, Atte, and Freddie Lessing. And we were all set to go when the call would come for us to go on the trains.
When was this? In 41, 42?
This is now 42. In 42, the Germans started to send transports out of Holland to work with them in Germany. They had also formed a Dutch concentration camp. It was a transit camp. It was called Westerbork. It was not far from the German border. And most of Holland's Jews were sent there first. And from there, every Tuesday, a train left with more than 1,000 fathers, mothers, children, grandparents, all newborn babies, every Tuesday, more than 1,000 every week. And so we were ready to, when the call came, for us to go on those trains.
But you didn't. But you didn't. What was it that convinced your mother and father say, this is a bad idea?
Interesting. One morning, my grandfather from Amsterdam, Isaac Lessing, showed up and wanted to know what my parents were doing about that work relief in Germany. And I have no proof, but I assume they showed him with a little bit of pride that how well we were prepared with those backpacks, with our names on them, with the warm clothes in them. And I seem to remember my father saying in a conversation with friends that he didn't care to work hard in Germany. He worked hard 7 days as a musician in Holland, 7 days a week, you know. So he said, so we'll work hard in Germany. And my grandfather said, who lived in Amsterdam, by the way, in a Jewish area, he said, there are rumors going around in Amsterdam that there is no such thing as work relief in Germany. He said, there are rumors going around, God forbid, the Germans are lying to us. And he said, you must never go on those trains. I'm afraid if you go on those trains, I'll never see you back. Don't go on those trains. You must go and try and hide somewhere. I'll try and help you. And I've often tried to picture my parents' mind, what they must have thought. Here's my grandfather saying there's no such thing as that work relief. Where were those trains going every week with our fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, grandparents? Good Dutch, naive, wonderful people. What were little babies doing at work relief? What were 90-year-old seniors doing at that work relief that didn't exist? And nobody knew where those trains were going. But my parents made a decision. They decided we weren't going to go on the trains. We were going to try and hide. And so, on the 23rd of October 1942, very early in the morning, we took the stars of our jackets, threw them in the wastebasket, and walked out of our home. I remember my mother pulling the door shut behind her. There was a plumber working in the house on something. We never told him. We walked to the suburb, one of the suburbs of Delft, and we had a very good older couple living there, very good friends. And there we stayed for that day. And as I always say, that night I lost my family. I no longer had a home, I was homeless. My father and mother went out after dark, out of the door, and to go and hide someplace. My little brothers were picked up by friends, Christian friends, to be hidden somewhere else. I still had a few days to stay with these good friends until there was a hiding place found for me. But that night I lost my father, my mother, and my brothers, my home. Not only that, but I was a fugitive from the law from that day on.
And you were 16 years old.
I was 16 years old, and anyone who could find me trying to hide could report me either to the Germans or to the collaborating Dutch police. They would get a reward of, I think it was 7 Dutch guilders, having found a Jew who was trying to hide. And that was the situation at that point.
But you had no, your parents really didn't have a plan. They were just other than to get away.
doesn't seem that they had a plan. What happened at that point was that my mother sort of changed from a housewife to the center of this, my story, really, which is that she became a Jewish war hero. She's the one who immediately got a false identity card and a false name and began traveling through Holland on the trains, trying to find hiding places for us all. She found a hiding place for herself and for her husband with a childless couple somewhere in the center of Holland. She found hiding places for my two little brothers independently. And she came back to me and said, Ed, I can't find anyone who's willing to take a 16-year-old Jewish boy like you. We have to think of something else. My mother never gave up. She always had made a plan. And she said, this is what I think we should do. I'm going to try and find somewhere in Holland a little farm, and you're going to work there as a stable boy, just for bed and board. You're not going to earn money. You're going to get a new name, and you're going to get a new identity card, and we're going to bleach you. We have to bleach your hair because you look too Jewish. In those days, most Dutch kids had blonde hair and blue eyes. I didn't, and so.
Although you do have blue eyes, though, don't you? Or
yeah, not really. Yeah, I have lighter eyes, but my hair was too dark, and the Dutch people could distinguish from seeing, you know. Holland was not a country like the United States where you could say, oh, it's probably an Italian guy. They were Dutch, and that was it. And then there were some foreigners like me, but we weren't really foreigners. Mm-hmm. And we could, as a Jewish kid, could recognize Jewish people in the street, mm-hmm. by their, somehow. So we bleached my hair. It's one of the few jokes I tell when I speak to the kids. I say, I was supposed to come out blonde, but I came out a very cute redhead instead, which is true. But my mother found a farm. Very tiny little farm deep in the center of Holland somewhere, and I went to work there as a pretend Gentile kid, stable boy. My mother had a whole story.
Did the owners of the farm know you were Jewish? No, she really fooled everybody.
I was there with that dark secret of my mother had said, Ed, don't ever let on who you really are, because that will be the end of your life. So I was there, and I had to wear wooden shoes, which made my feet bleed, because they weren't used to that. And I had to dig ditches in all soggy ground.
And you were a city kid, all of a sudden transported.
I was a city kid, even special some city kid out of a Jewish family, even though they were not synagogue goers, but my parents were, in that sense, very Jewish, humanely Jewish. But here I was in almost like a medieval setting. No electricity, no gas, just no running water. So outhouses, and I had to work, and I had to milk cows at 5 o'clock in the morning in the rain outside. And mostly I had to get used to to what they gave me to eat, and what they ate, which was black bread liberally smeared with lard. That was sort of what you ate for breakfast then.
So this is a family of farmers. How many people were in the family?
A husband, a wife, and one little boy, and there was me.
And how long were you there for?
I'm not quite sure how long, but it must have been about maybe four months, 5 months, when I just couldn't. I was so terrified. So scared. Whenever anyone approached the farm, I thought they'd come and get me. They were coming to get me. At night, I couldn't sleep, trying to listen if anybody was approaching. And so lonely. I mean, I had no one. I was there by myself with that terrible secret hanging over my head all the time. One slip of the tongue, one misstep, and then I would, the farmer might think, hey, this kid isn't who he pretends to be, you know, let's call the police or whatever.
Did the family treat you well, though, despite that, or were they just indifferent?
No, they didn't treat me. The farmers didn't know about that kind of thing of treating someone well.
You were a hired hand.
It was free labor. It wasn't the best labor. You had to even train them, you know. You had to show them how to pull a calf out of a cow with a rope when she couldn't give birth, you know. And this kid didn't know the damn thing, you know. So, but he was given food and, you know, and warmth and a place to sleep. And that was it. So after some months, I met my mother secretly somewhere in a field, and I said, "Mom, I can't do it anymore. I'm too lonely. I'm too scared. I'm going to give myself up to the Germans." I said, "They're going to get me anyway." And my mother said, "Please, Ed, don't commit suicide. I'll try and find someone." And through a interesting coincidence, which I don't need to go into detail here, but she found a Dutch policeman who, from all outward signs, would be a very good Dutch Nazi. He never smiled, gruff, wore a pitch black uniform, black hat, black shoes, black boots, service revolver. Very dangerous looking character. However, he was good. He was the head of the Dutch resistance group in his area. And he said to me, "Ed, I can place you in a place where you will not be alone. There will be other men there," he said. "But," he said, "it's an extremely dangerous place. And you, once you go in, you cannot come out. You will have no connection with your mother anymore, not with your parents, no one. But you will not be alone, and you will be other people. Would you like to go there?" So I was so fearful and so terrified and so lonely and so horrible, you know, that I decided anything would be better. And so one night, the police officer, I have a photograph of him, by the way, if you want to photograph it later, took me outside of his village on a gravel road, and we walked some miles, and all of a sudden he stopped in front of a parcel of woods. And I thought, why the hell is he stopping here? I mean, it looked like solid Christmas trees, you know, solid undergrowth. You couldn't go in there. But there was a little tree that you lifted up, and then there was a zigzagging path to the center of the woods, and you put a little pantry behind you again. And the policeman took me on the zigzagging path, and all of a sudden, in the center of the woods, I was confronted by a wooden hut, which had been camouflaged by nailing little pine trees to it, so you hardly noticed until you stood right in front of it. And that's where he left me with seven Dutch Gentile men, not Jewish men, who had formed a resistance group against the Germans. And this was their headquarters. So all of a sudden, I was in this group, and they weren't all that friendly to me, because when I found out much later that in a general meeting of the group, several voices had gone up that no Jews, that Jews were unreliable. Mm-hmm. And if there ever was a raid or something, and they caught a Jew, and then he would spill the beans, and they would be in danger. But the policeman, who really was the head of the resistance in his area, twisted their arms, I guess. And so they took me in. But slowly, as time went by, I was accepted, I was given tasks to do.
What was the resistance group, what form did their resistance take?
Yeah, it was not what you call a partisan group. They did not bomb railroad lines and all that. What they would do is, after dark, they would go out. They would break into town halls and police stations there they would steal German rubber stamps so we could make false documents. And they would steal especially weapons and uniforms, of which we had a cache in the ground next to our hut. And of course, I asked him, hey, could you take me along, you know? I had been a Boy Scout, this sounded like great. And they said, Ed, they said, we can't take you along. You're only 17 years old. This isn't Boy Scout game. If they catch us, they'll stand you up against the wall and they'll shoot you. So we can't, you'll be killed. They wouldn't take me on their raids. They gave me other jobs to do, and I won't go into detail because that would take a long time, but actually it was very interesting to be there. One day, two strangers were brought in ill-fitting suits. Came out, these were two crew members of a Lancaster bomber which had crashed near the German border. And these two had the resistance had gotten to them before the Germans, and they were shielded, and then they were given suits, and they wound up in our hut with us. And when they came in, I, who spoke the best English, it's very interesting. I spoke the best English, mostly from listening to the BBC radio, but I later on found out it was because of my 3 years having spoken fluent American in Massachusetts as a 3-year-old boy. I was asked to interview, for instance, one of them, because the suspicion was that they might be German spies.